It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, youth mental health can be tough to talk about. A Wisconsin event invited kids to lead the discussion by sharing their own experiences. We'll talk to a reporter who helped organize events around the state. First, Governor Scott Walker says it may be time for the state to take over control of Milwaukee public schools and possibly to break the district up into smaller districts. He made the comments during an interview Sunday on Upfront with Mike Gushay. He also criticized State Superintendent Tony Evers, who's running for governor as one of many Democrats, for failing to turn the district around. Here's Walker speaking yesterday at an event in Milwaukee.
No, I think for the parents and for the students in this city, it is a moral imperative that things get better.
In a statement, Superintendent Evers said he's worked with teachers and school officials in Milwaukee and that graduation rates, summer school, and college scholarships had improved. He said students need a governor to help the district grow and evolve, not a, quote, dictator. Walker says he doesn't have a plan yet to take over MPS, but if he comes up with one, he would talk about it before the November election. Alan Borsick is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School. He's an education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, former education reporter. Alan, welcome back to Central Time.
Pleased to be here.
Let's start with the problems at Milwaukee Public Schools. We've talked about this a lot before. From the latest data, from the latest numbers and anecdotes, what is the state of MPS right now?
Well, it's pretty troubled. I don't know any other way to put it. And I would say it's as troubled as any time in the 20 or 30 years that I've been following this. They have big financial problems. They've got more cuts coming. They've got a very unhappy workforce. The teachers are threatening what they call bold action without being more specific to oppose the budget. Certainly have low student achievement, which is just a subject you can't get around. That the percentage of kids who are in MPS who are reading at grade level, and I might add the percentage of kids in the private schools in Milwaukee, both of them is 20% roughly, which means 80% of them are not reading at grade level according to the state tests. You've got declining enrollment in MPS. You have a lot of competition for kids. A lot of problems just in general with the climate for children in the city of Milwaukee. It's just really, and a change of leadership. The superintendent is leaving, which is in itself. So it's a long list of formidable problems that MPS is facing currently.
Governor Walker floating the idea of the state taking more control, says state law allows the superintendent of public instruction to do that. We've been here before, right? There's been talk of state intervention, more state intervention in Milwaukee public schools before. What have people talked about in the past?
Well, in the late 90s, then Governor Tommy Thompson said the state should take over MPS if it didn't meet certain performance goals and improved attendance, improved test scores. And then kind of moved away from that, which MPS did not meet the goals, but the state didn't do anything about it. In 2009, then Governor Doyle called for a creation of a governance system for MPS that would largely be under the control of the mayor of Milwaukee, and that got nowhere. In fact, it was stopped largely, and Governor Walker correctly points out, it was stopped largely by Democrats in the legislature. 3 years ago, you had the creation in the state budget of what was called the Opportunity Schools Program, which was supposed to take away some of the lowest performing schools from MPS and put them under other operators, and that became hugely controversial but didn't produce anything. There's a theme here of big ideas producing nothing. I might add that in 2009, when he was running for governor, Scott Walker said he wanted to break up MPS into districts maybe the size of Wauwatosa, which is where his kids went to school. But he never pursued that idea in the 9 years since then.
The idea of a state takeover, or at least more state control, that suggests that the problem is, I guess, a problem of governance in Milwaukee public schools, that somebody needs to come from the outside and do a better job at the top. Is that where you see the problems? Is that where the focus should be?
Oh, I'm going to dodge giving a direct answer to that. There's certainly a lot of people who would say that. I think people in the business community in Milwaukee and people in the Republican side of the legislature, some civic leaders in Milwaukee would say, you know, the school board is a force to prevent change. The school board may well be one of the reasons that the current superintendent, Darian Driver, is leaving. On the other hand, I think the general public sentiment in Milwaukee and at the street level, so to speak, would be very opposed to that. They don't want outsiders coming in and forcing anything. Certainly the position of the district itself and of the teachers union would be highly opposed.
Talking to Alan Borsick from Marquette University Law School, longtime education writer at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at an idea refloated by Governor Walker of state intervention in Milwaukee public schools, maybe breaking the schools into smaller districts. And let's talk about that idea, Alan. It seems like an easy idea to say. It might be hard to implement. What would that take to break a big district into smaller ones?
Frankly, I don't have any idea. It would be really complicated. The way everything is enmeshed now within the Milwaukee Public School system, enrollment, kids go to school all over the city, the amount of school choice, to use that term, within MPS itself is really quite high. And then you add on the layers of the Milwaukee private school voucher program and charter schools, and you have kids going to school all over the place. How you would break up MPS, how you would do it as a business proposition, as terms of assigning teachers, assigning students, what schools would stay open, funding, it would be really, really complex. It's easy to advocate, and this is one enormously scrambled egg that it's really hard to see how you would unscramble it.
And you mentioned the budget earlier, a budget shortfall MPS is looking at. A district spokesperson says they need more state aid. Governor Walker says, no, we're given plenty of money. It's how it's managed and spent. What do you make of the budget situation there? Is there a shortfall in aid from the state?
Well, again, it's a political judgment. The actual amount of state aid Milwaukee gets is actually in the middle of the pack when it comes to per student amounts compared to other districts in the state. It's less than some. It's more than some. You could argue that Milwaukee, with its intense poverty, really should get more and needs more support. The governor would say, well, they're getting plenty. The cuts that are envisioned by the school administration in the current budget proposal, which is supposed to come to a head by the end of this month, are not in themselves that severe, but they come in the context of cuts in so many recent years, and you just keep stepping down, and increasing class size and whatever. The more this progresses, or the more it goes, you know, increases, the more it becomes a problem. So there is a huge blowback currently by teachers in MPS.
You mentioned the politics of this, and this is all coming in an election year, an election for governor. You've got the governor speaking out on this. One of his potential Democratic opponents is the superintendent of public instruction, the head of education in the state. Is there a long history of the Milwaukee public schools being used as kind of a political football?
Oh, I would say so, and the politics of it. Outside of Milwaukee, you know, MPS is not very popular. So Governor Walker, if anything, probably stands to gain by looking like he's getting tough on MPS with the people and in the areas that are more likely to support him. Whereas Tony Evers, the state superintendent, and all of the Democratic candidates would be more supportive of MPS, more supportive of the need for state aid. The biggest problem isn't that there's a lack of interest or advocacy or controversy. It's there's a lack of improvement. I mean, there's some incremental stuff, but the overall results in Milwaukee, and for that matter statewide in some ways, just really need some serious, and I would hope, healthy, constructive, and I might even say nonpartisan attention and cooperation, and you're not going to see that in an election year.
Yeah, I was going to say, but how about 2019, whoever wins this election for governor, do you think that there's an open door, a way to get people together, set aside the politics, and actually try to be constructive on all this?
Do I think there's a way to do that? Yes. Do I think it'll happen? That I'm more skeptical about, just because we live in such polarized and heated times politically, but the situation in Milwaukee in general and Milwaukee Public Schools specifically is getting to a point where you say, we really need to sit down and figure out what's best for the kids of the city, because this is so central to the future of the state and the state's economy.
Alan, thanks again for joining us today.
Glad to be with you.
That's Alan Borsak, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School, also an education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, longtime education reporter. We talked with him about the prospects of a state takeover of Milwaukee public schools. First, kids in Wisconsin are speaking out about mental health.
Hi, my name is Erica Williams-Clark. I'm a senior at the Milwaukee High School of the Arts, and I'm here to talk about my cousin. On January 17th, 2017, we get the worst news ever. It's supposed to be welcoming a new year. My aunt walked into the house and say, Naima just passed. She took her own life. And I can feel everyone feeling really sad in the room. And it was a big pit in my heart that was hurting. How could my 13-year-old cousin, beautiful, beautiful cousin, ever want to harm herself? What was going on? And the most scariest thing was that she disguised all this hurt and pain from us. We didn't even know.
That story and several others were shared at Milwaukee's Kids in Crisis Day of Action. The event was one of three held in the state this year as part of a special series covering youth who are dealing with things like depression, anxiety, loss, and the search for identity. Rory Linane is a reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. She organized the Milwaukee Kids in Crisis Day of Action events and covers youth mental health for the Kids in Crisis series. Rory, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, tell us a little more about what happened at these Kids in Crisis events.
Yeah, well, our goal this year was really to center youth voices throughout the whole series. So at the events, we tried to have young people sharing their stories. And in some cases, we also had experts there who could add some context and talk about some local resources for mental health.
And you've been working on this Kids in Crisis series for quite a while now. We've talked to you about it in the past. Why is it important for kids to tell their own stories and for us to hear their stories?
Yeah, well, they are the people who are going through this. And so when we're trying to figure out how best to address youth mental health challenges, I think it makes the most sense to ask young people themselves. And I think we often don't give them enough credit for how much they understand what's going on inside them and how much commitment they have to making sure that other people don't have to suffer the ways that they have. And they're just really passionate about bringing down stigma around mental health.
And in that story we just heard from Erica about her cousin and her cousin's suicide, as she said, the scariest thing was that she disguised all this hurt and pain. That's what you're trying to help bridge here, the idea that people are suffering in silence and afraid, maybe ashamed to talk about it.
Yeah, definitely. Erica talked a lot about that, how that happened with her cousin. And now that she has seen firsthand how people can really hide their pain, it's changed the way that she watches her friends and talks to her friends. And, you know, for me, too, from working on this series, it changes the way that you address mental health, and it makes you want to be really direct about it with the people you love to make sure that they'll be okay.
And Rory, we think of mental health problems as something that people don't want to talk about. They might be afraid of a stigma. So you put this out there for kids, say, in high school to talk about. What kind of response did you get? Was there a hunger to start bringing these issues out?
Definitely. I think there was a hunger on the part of the people sharing their stories and on the part of the people who are reading the stories and coming to the events. I was nervous about whether we'd find young people who really wanted to do this. And we also wanted to be really careful that this was a good, positive experience for them, because when you go public, you can get some positive and negative feedback. So before we did the events, we had all of the young people, we had a couple workshops with them where they could talk with a mental health professional and figure out whether this was something they wanted to do. And in the end, I think all of the young people were really happy that they shared their stories. And it was an empowering experience for them. And the audience was in tears. Everyone was hugging after the events because they were so moving and really inspiring.
I want to listen to another one of the storytellers who participated. Here's TJ Esser, a sophomore at Germantown High School.
my mom, my dad, and my sister were in my parents' room having just like a family meeting while they were having like a meeting with each of the kids. And my sister went in there first and was like, there's something going on with TJ and it's not my place to tell you. And my mom freaked out and came in by me and thought something really bad was going on. You can't force me to come out to you. And she was like, you're gay? I was like, no. I'm trans. And she was like, what does that mean? And I was like, oh, well, so this is gonna be a trip. So I came out to my mom, and then my dad had come in by that point. And then he heard me say it. And my dad came in and was like, I'm proud of you. I'm sorry that you have to go through this. I'm like, it's not something to be sorry for. It's just something to deal with.
So TJ talked about his experience of being transgender, in part, I guess, before he knew what was happening and how. What other kinds of stories came out from these events?
Yeah, there was a wide range of stories. I really like TJ's story because one part of our series talked about how LGBTQ students are more often experience mental health challenges and more often have suicidal thoughts. And it's important to understand that that's not a result of being an LGBTQ student, but a result of the discrimination that they face in their schools and other environments. And so TJ talked about how being transgender is not a problem, but a solution to a problem, and that people have to embrace that in order to support the mental health of LGBT students. So that was a great story, and we also heard from students all over the state with different types of mental health challenges.
We're talking to Rory Linane with USA Today Network Wisconsin, organizer of Milwaukee Kids in Crisis Day of Action events. She's been covering youth mental health for the Kids in Crisis series. Rory, stepping away from these stories for a moment, let's look at the big picture. You've written about efforts to measure how we're delivering mental health to kids and families and how it's working. What do we know about what's going on in Wisconsin?
Not as much as we probably should know. So we looked at some surveys that have been being sent out to parents of children with severe emotional disabilities who receive some state-funded services. And we saw that from 2006 to 2016, in every year, less than half of parents said they were seeing positive results from the services they were receiving. And specifically for African-American parents, the number was only 29%, which is a lot lower than the national average of 66% satisfaction with the services. So those numbers didn't look good, but when we started asking about them, officials also pointed out that it's a really limited sample size and that there are other children who don't have as severe of emotional disabilities, but less severe mental health challenges, who we don't have this kind of data for. So the director of the Office of Children's Mental Health basically said, we don't have a good measure for knowing how kids are doing and what services are being effective.
That said, by that incomplete measure, when it's compared to similar measures in other states, you had charts. Wisconsin's not doing very well. Other states seem to be improving. We don't. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right. When you compare, it's hard to compare apples to apples when you look at other states, but because every state does their survey differently, but we do fall toward the bottom. And when you look over time, we haven't seen improvement in Wisconsin.
Now, you've been covering mental health for a while, youth mental health, in this Kids in Crisis series. You've brought people together to talk. You've brought youth together. Do you see, at least even if we're not seeing health improvements, mental health improvements, like more openness to have this conversation?
Definitely. Yeah, I think just in the past few years that we've been doing this series, we've seen it. We've at our event in Madison, we had a lawmaker up there talking about how he went to therapy. So I think people at all levels are becoming more comfortable sharing their own experiences. And we've also had a new podcast this year called This Is Normal, where we had students from all over the state sharing their stories publicly.
Are you still looking for students to tell their stories, whether it's at a one-day event or on the podcast?
Yeah, always. The podcast season is over, but mental health is an issue that we're never going to stop covering. So always looking to connect with more people.
What kind of stories are you looking to cover next as you continue the Kids in Crisis series?
That is kind of unclear at this point. I think our kind of season is over, so we're regrouping and seeing where to go next.
And when it comes to state efforts to deal with mental health problems, state and local and school efforts, what kind of things do we have out there? What kind of resources are there for younger people and their families?
I think there's a wide variety. There are some resources at the county level, and then there are also resources in the schools. And I'll also shout out the Hope Line. It's a text-in support line at 741-741. If you just text the Hope Line to that number at any time, there will be trained volunteers who can help you talk through any emergency emotional issues that you might be having.
And then in reading some of your series, it seems like kids who have been through either mental health problems themselves or like Erica, who we heard at the beginning, who have seen it in their families, at least some of them have this desire to help others, to help other kids going through the same stuff. Is that something you're hearing a lot?
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of the people who have become the greatest advocates have stepped into that position because they've seen kind of the harm that can happen when we don't talk about these things.
Rory, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Rory Linane, reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. She joined us to talk about the Kids in Crisis Day of Action events in the state and the ongoing Kids in Crisis series, drawing attention to the stories of Wisconsin youth dealing with mental health problems. First, there are people who consider owning guns to be a major part of their lives, and there are non-gun owners who may know little about guns and their use. But what happens when a non-gun owner starts taking a look at the internet culture of gun owners? Our next guest says that watching YouTube videos showing a perspective that we disagree with can help us understand people on the other side of a debate. Connie Hassett-Walker is an associate professor in the Department of Criminal Justice at Keene University in New Jersey. Her forthcoming book is called Guns on the Internet, Online Gun Communities, First Amendment Protections, and the Search for Common Ground on Gun Control. Connie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, one of the initial subjects of your research here was you. Can you talk about where you started on the gun issue and why you started watching videos made by gun owners, gun enthusiasts?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny thing, because why would somebody do that? I myself am not a gun owner. I'm married to a gun owner. My husband started owning guns some years after we were married, so I have some experience around them. I've fired guns. I've been to the range. He talks to me about them all the time. I didn't really take to it myself, but my impression is, and maybe some of the callers will have different experiences, but my impression is people who handle guns do a lot of like cleaning and modifying, and you buy this, you know, gun that might cost you, you know, say $900, and then it doesn't quite fit your hand. So you want to know how to make it fit your hand better. So you go on YouTube and you watch. There's like a whole host of these DIY type videos for people who want to. I'm considering buying this gun versus that gun. Which one do I want? Which type of ammunition are going to work best with the type of gun that I have? So my husband would watch these type of videos, and I sort of walked in on him one day and saw one, and I was just fascinated by the particular type of video that he was watching at the time was a bump firing video. Now, bump firing with bump stock got a lot of attention after the Las Vegas shooting, but I'm watching this man demonstrate how to bump fire his weapon, which makes it fire rapidly as if it's an automatic weapon. And I thought, wow, how can he do that? And I didn't think citizens could own automatic weapons. And how is he making it do that? And isn't he afraid he's going to get arrested? And what other kinds of videos are out there like that? And then the next sort of logical leap was, well, what about Facebook? And what about Twitter? And what about blogs? So it led to this kind of half-decade exploration of all the ways that really gun culture, how it operates on social media.
And did you feel like you started to change your thoughts about people who did and didn't own guns as you kind of dug further and further into these videos and cultures?
I did, and probably part of it is no doubt the fact that I live with a gun owner, but I wasn't raised around guns. My parents were, but I wasn't, but I didn't know much about them, and I live in New Jersey. New Jersey, if you know anything about gun laws, New Jersey is very strict. But in watching the videos, I've I'd heard the statistics, like if you households that have a gun in the house are more likely to have a suicide or a homicide by tenfold. And as I started watching the videos, I became, over time, more sort of neutral on the subject, neutral to gun-friendly. And I also was surprised to find that I developed some favorites. There were certain videos and certain channels that I would return to, because you don't know these people in real life, but they're, you know, it's like you're watching a little, you have a like slice into their life, like a little window into their world, to their like these home movies, and some people are funny and some people are personable, and so I found myself returning to those videos. So I sort of shifted, I guess I did shift over time.
I want to give a listen to one of them, a clip from a YouTube user who uses his gun for tactical zombie training.
Hey, Hickok 45 here. Doing a little zombie training again today, and I know you guys like to come with me when I do that. Maybe you learn something, maybe you don't. But foliage is out, you know, the bushes and leaves and everything. It's difficult to see those things, you know, when they get into the vicinity. So you can never train too much. Got the old DZSG back out, Remington an 870, and we're just going to proceed through the woods here and, you know, kind of get ourselves ready. You know, you got to stay ready for this kind of thing. So come on with me if you like.
And he proceeds to shoot some targets with zombies on them. And quite a character there. And you say, as you just said, you kind of connect to some of these characters.
Yeah, and these are just regular people. They're not like, you know, the lobbyists or the spokespeople. They're just, you know, sort of regular people like you and me, and they make these videos, and then people comment, and then they respond to the comments. So it kind of creates this sense of community online. People go for information. They go for connectedness. They have questions. Sometimes they argue, but there's a real kind of thriving online gun subculture that I was unaware of, and I bet a lot of people, unless they're in it, a lot of people are also unaware of it.
Connie Hassett-Walker is with us with the Department of Criminal Justice at Keene University. Her forthcoming book is Guns on the Internet. And Connie, you think there's you write that there's a bigger point going on here. We have this very, no secret, very divisive debate on gun issues in the United States. You say if we all start watching the other side's videos more, we may not end up agreeing with everybody, but the corrosive nature of the debate might help, might go away a little bit.
Yeah, I propose this idea at the end of the book called the 100 YouTube Video Challenge, which is grounded in, for all the academics out there, it's grounded in parasocial interaction theory, which is the idea that people can form kind of attachments and connectedness and familiarity to media personalities. So the idea, and I don't know if this would work, but I would love it if somebody would test it, even if they think it's a dumb idea and they want to disprove it. So the idea is, say you get, for like a pilot test, you get 50 people on the gun control side who are going to watch 100 YouTube videos with an open mind, and not like the ones from NRA TV or the lobbyists, but just sort of regular people. And this is their homemade YouTube channel. And vice versa, you get 100 gun owners to watch 100 gun control videos. Those are trickier to find, so I make some suggestions in the book about videos that might work. And then after going through that process, when hypothetically the people on both sides might have a little bit more familiarity and sense of connectedness and maybe empathy to the other side, then we can come together and have a conversation about what can we live with, all of us, on this issue of gun rights and gun control, because it's just a battle now, right? So it's an idea for how to maybe increase familiarity to then start a conversation. I'm interested. I don't make specific suggestions about gun control provisions because that's been done by others. I'm kind of interested in what could happen before we talk about that.
And we hear again and again this idea that we're living in filter bubbles, that the internet makes it really easy to only see stuff that we agree with. Internet algorithms help us do that. If I look at one side of the gun debate, the Google or YouTube or whatever is going to keep reinforcing that point of view. It sounds like you're saying, hey, we need to be really intentional about breaking through that bubble.
Yeah, I mean, people look for the things they look for. And I put this out there in a piece I wrote for The Conversation, which is kind of a blog, journalistic type blog for academics, academics write for it. And I got, a variety of responses. Some people thought it was a good idea. Some people said, oh, it's the stupidest idea I've ever heard. And that's fine. That's why, prove me wrong. I mean, go, nothing can be hurt from trying to test this out. But it, we tend to go online and look for the things we want to see. This might is sort of a suggestion to go look for things we wouldn't normally look for, maybe don't want to see.
We are talking with Connie Hassett-Walker, associate professor in the Department of Criminal Justice at Keene University in New Jersey. She's explored the subculture of guns and gun owners by watching YouTube videos, going to social media groups, and more. She says even with a really divisive debate, like the debate over guns, maybe we can bridge some of the divide by understanding the other side, by watching what they're doing, what ordinary people are saying about their positions online. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a gun owner yourself? Are you part of these online communities? Do you watch these DIY videos on YouTube that she's talking about? Do you have a favorite? Are you part of Facebook groups or others related to owning and using guns? Why is firearm ownership important to you? If you're not a gun owner, do you feel like you know enough about guns? Do you feel like you wish you knew more or you don't need to know more? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue the conversation with Connie Hassett-Walker, associate professor in the Department of Criminal Justice at Keene University in New Jersey. We're talking about gun culture and how guns fit into the lives of those who own them. She went on an experiment. She watched YouTube videos produced by gun owners, looked at social media sites that brought them together. She says that can give us insight into people with different perspectives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see yourself as a part of online gun culture? Do you have a favorite producers of firearm-related videos on YouTube? Do you have questions for a guest? What do you think of this idea of watching videos from a side that you disagree with, whether it's in the gun debate or others? Call 800-642-1234 or comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Want to give a listen to another person you watched, Connie. This is Heather. Her channel is Heather Vlogs, Vlogs. I should know that. Lots of subscribers. Here's Heather's first experience with a Glock.
Happy perky bouncy. Come on, come on, come on, come on. Give me the attitude. Bam, 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 bam. Come on, come on. Go, 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 go. Yeah. Bam, there you go. Yeah, get work it out, work it out. Come on. Happy perky bouncy. Come on.
Look, I bought Heather this new Glock, and she didn't like it, so she gave it to me. And as bad as I hate to admit this, because I've always been a 1911 person, and I always thought that a Glock felt like a toy, you know, all the plastic and stuff, and but I gotta admit, it shoots really good. I know, I hate to admit that, but it shoots really good. And I can hit quite a bit with it. Wanna try it, Heather? Huh? You know you wanna try it.
We didn't get to hear much of Heather there, but this channel is one you call a favorite for you and others. Why is that?
Well, I like not that specific one. That's right. I think Heather and Jeff, I'm guessing, is her husband. They have this whole the Southern Life with Heather and Jeff, and they're fun to watch. They do gun videos, but they don't just do gun videos. They sort of do it in the context of, how they live and Southern living and hunting, and Heather spends a weekend in the woods at Jeff's request and doesn't like it and stuff. So it's just you see it's. You sort of feel like you're going on the journey with them. So I found myself gravitating towards videos that I thought were funny, and I was more, because I'm not a gun person, I am less interested in the guns themselves, but I'm sort of interested in the people and sort of their expressions and how they, talk when they're just relaxed and joking with each other. And so that I just, they're some of the ones I like to watch their videos.
Let's go to our callers now. Allison is with us in Milwaukee. Allison, hi.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Good. So it is an interesting dilemma. So my husband and I both are very, more liberal, left-leaning for sure. We have two little girls, and a few years ago, our stance on guns was anti-handgun, anti-gun. We live in Milwaukee, and a break-in. We were all sleeping, and someone broke into our home while we were asleep, and our alarm went off. Our ADT went off. And After that happened, his position drastically changed on handguns. We had lots of months of sleepless nights, and he traveled for work, and I couldn't sleep. And so now he has many, five or six guns in the home that are in a locked safe, of course, a finger-proof safe. But it's crazy how I'm still grappling with this choice of wanting to be able to protect my family and having the right to have guns, right? I don't want to pick one up. I've tried, once I thought I heard something, and I couldn't even figure out how to get the safe open because I was so nervous. So I'm not a born gun person. But he has gone the other direction. And it causes, our dinner parties are always fun and lots of people arguing over guns. And it's interesting. But it's when you have experiences like that happen to you, I can see how, and I've watched him go from a very hardcore left liberal position to having one bad experience and wanting to protect his family, going way over to another side and watching these videos and watching things on guns. And it's just, as an observer and someone who's been in it, and just a self struggle with grappling of, I'm against handguns. I watch these school shootings and it makes me want to throw up, right? It's so awful.
Yeah.
And then seeing him. So it's just interesting how those things and experiences can change you so drastically.
Allison, thanks a lot for sharing that story. And I'm sorry you and your family went through that with the break-in. But Connie, this is part of what you're interested in, the personal stories of people grappling with these issues, not necessarily the talking points that we've all heard a zillion times.
Yeah, that must have been really scary for Allison, was her name.
Allison,
the decision to get a gun or not get a gun is a really personal one, and I myself am not a gun person, and I feel awkward handling them, but that may be her experience as well. And so the talking points. We hear about the scary stuff, and certainly being a crime victimization experience might be a reason somebody would want to own a gun, buy a gun, carry a gun to protect themselves. There's a lot more. There's just a whole world that's out there that is sort of the. I'm not trying to minimize gun violence. The videos that I saw, and there are tens of thousands of them that are just. All different types of experiences, the fun stuff, the pride in being a good shooter, the camaraderie with your friends all going out together. What I'm suggesting is if people want to, kind of go into the world of online gun videos to, it's hard on an issue of guns to keep an open mind, but to try to do it because it's interesting the stuff that you see. I thought it was really fascinating.
Thanks for that call, Allison. We'll go next to Kevin in Barneveld. Kevin, hi.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call. I would just first like to say that I was exposed to guns at a very young age. At the age of 18, I enlisted into the service and through no fault of my own, became a small weapons specialist. And I fired all different types of handguns and what the Army considers small weapons, which is up to... and including 50 caliber machine gun. A gun is a tool. And there's gun people and there's people that aren't gun people. And I liken those to people that are dog people and people that are cat people. There will always be room for some movement here and some compromise, but the two will never meet. They will never come together in the middle. You will never convince a gun person to not be a gun person or vice versa. And I'll just like to say two more things. This country was built on the gun. If there was no gun, there would be no America. And so my second point is, whether you are in favor of guns or you aren't in favor of guns, when you absolutely have to have a gun, nothing else works.
Kevin, thanks a lot for that call. I want to go to his point, Connie, saying... basically, they're never going to bridge the gap. You're not going to change people. You're not necessarily hoping that people are going to change their minds, but that they can find at least a common ground to argue along.
Yeah, I know. I think Kevin makes a good point. And I'm wondering, instead of thinking about how can we come together, I've been wondering if it's thinking in terms of is it possible to, if we can make an effort to get more familiar with the other side. I mean, it's the easiest thing in the world to demonize your enemy, right, your opponent. They're terrible. They're nothing like me. It's more complicated to think that we have more in common than different. What could we all live with? You know, when there's a car crash, and that you hear a lot of comparisons of guns to cars, like understanding all the parts and the attachments and stuff about guns is sort of like understanding all the things under the hood of a car. When somebody gets into a car crash, like a drunk driver gets into a car crash, we don't immediately call for banning cars. We understand that some places we have cars and you need them, and other places there's good public transportation. It's about sort of the driver of the car. And I'm wondering, in kind of the culture wars that we have now, there are, you know, a variety of things. There's immigration, environment, abortion. We don't have cars as part of the culture wars. And I'm wondering if it wouldn't be possible to have guns be like cars. Something terrible happens, like a Parkland shooting, like a Las Vegas shooting. I don't know, if it's possible to shift the debate so there's something we could all live with, if that makes sense.
Now, there might be people on the anti-gun side of the debate who say, you know, maybe we've got plenty of guns. We've got a lot of guns in this country. Gun culture is all around us. We see, you know, the regular death toll of shootings and the mass shootings like Parkland you just mentioned. People don't necessarily want to know more. They don't want to dig into a world that normalizes firearms.
Yeah, but if we're just stuck, you know, we're just stuck. We battle over this issue, and it's just, I'm wondering if there isn't a way through social media. And it's an idea. I don't know that it would work, but to find, you know, become more familiar with each other so we can listen more, battle less, and just come to something that we could all live with, not necessarily like, not having, you know, people, non-gun people become gun owners and vice versa, but something we could all sort of tolerate so we don't have to keep fighting this over and over again, because we're just treading water.
Now, you're coming to this from a perspective as a criminal justice professor. Is this
right,
sort of outside the mainstream in the normal, the sort of work you and your colleagues would usually do?
Not all of them, but probably criminal justice is a little bit more towards the violence prevention, gun control side. But there are certainly people who do work on the gun rights side. There aren't a lot of people who've looked at guns through the lens of social media, at least in criminal justice, that I know of.
And as we wrap up, Connie, you've got your book coming out. You've been doing this, so watching these videos for work for a long time. When the book is out, I mean, are there still YouTube producers you're going to follow, even if you don't need to?
Probably. I mean, this is sort of the year of me doing gun stuff. I may move on to a different area of research down the line. But, you know, I live with a gun owner, so it's always sort of a topic of conversation. He's always watching. You know, he bought a shotgun, and the shells aren't coming out, so he has to look. You know, it's always something that comes up for me personally.
Connie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thanks for having me.
That's Connie Hassett-Walker, associate professor in the Department of Criminal Justice at Keene University in New Jersey. She joined us to talk about the subculture of gun owners on the internet, and she says we could learn a lot from watching their videos or watching things that produced by people we disagree with on an issue. Her forthcoming book is called Guns on the Internet, Online Gun Communities, First Amendment Protections, and the Search for Common Ground on Gun Control. You can still join the conversation on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Our colleague Sarah McCammon from NPR tweeted this last night based on a random comment she heard. Quote, overheard in D.C., I could never live in a rural area, some random city like Wisconsin. End quote. I cleaned up the language a bit. Now, McCammon from NPR, a Midwesterner from Missouri herself, asked the person if they'd ever been to Wisconsin. The answer, no. So clearly a lot wrong with that quote she shared. And Twitter, especially Wisconsin-based Twitter, people were pretty quick to point out the flaws. Recapping the main points, Wisconsin, not a city. Wisconsin, not completely rural. Rural places, not bad. And rural Wisconsin, awesome in many ways. It reminds me of a comedy video I saw years ago. Bob Odenkirk is pitching a movie script to a movie producer, also played by Bob Odenkirk. I managed to track it down online.
First of all, it's set in Wisconsin.
What?
Wisconsin. You know Wisconsin.
What is it, like Narnia? You made it up?
No, it's a real place.
Who knows about it? Hipsters?
Yeah, hipsters and everybody.
Okay.
If you've ever had somebody from outside of Wisconsin not quite get it, maybe they don't think it's quite like Narnia, we'd love to hear from you. Email ideas@WPR.org. I think there's a segment in here somewhere. Watch for that sometime in the future here on Central Time.